It's entirely appropriate that I give this podcast while I'm standing next to a tree, out of the wind, I hope, about watching my daughter play soccer during a school day in a soccer competition. Let me describe the soccer competition for you at the moment. The local league soccer club is sponsoring all the local schools in a soccer competition, well, obviously a prize and something with it. So all the high schools and are getting together. There's actually three girls teams, and they're playing all day long, playing against each other. And it's a general commitment to sport in Australia. And earlier in the day, I chatted to my cousin, Andrew Hill, who's a professional sports strategist, so looking at alternative strategies for the world created by a world envisioned by businessmen, and that has sort of dominated the growth of Tennis Australia, and has led to a very good business model, which has actually sucked money out of grassroots tennis, shrunk tennis overall, and have overall led to basically a meltdown of ethics and morals in there. So there's a sort of a view of sports as a business and competition, and I was able to pass on to Andrew a bit of the history of pre-Australia sport, and it was very interesting to chat with him because unlike podcasting, you can chat, and certain information you realise is not already understood, and as you chat, you can actually build a scaffold or framework to go forward. Well, this person grabbed the soccer ball as it's coming towards him. You can build a framework to go forward. So he was very interested in terms of how the strategies, how you can build up alternative models of sport in Australia. And indeed, I suppose it is relevant, so that's what this podcast is going to be. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. In this case, the story of sports in Australia from a sort of the before the First Fleet, so to speak, and indeed before the First Fleet and beyond, in a simple model. And the idea is that this is can be developed to. As part of the thing to actually research the veracity of all of this, and I can vouch that I've read this from first-hand reports, first-hand documents, or actual documents from the time. So the development of that, but these documents are not necessarily known to people. They're not known in popular culture, as I've found out, but very important. So the idea of this particular podcast. This is the Peter Hill Explains thing, where I explain the tactics or the logic or the strategy behind the podcast, is that it supports the development of a different strategic understanding, which may indeed be investigated by politicians. There's a particular politician who's interested in hearing this, but also reinforced by academic study, the standard sort of civil service thing where you get a sort of the basic rigor. So this is a story, as I understood, just off there, just for knowing things and beginning to bring threads together. Now, the story of sport in Australia is, the origin of sport in Australia is something which is rather surprising. And it was, for me, surprising looking at this story of music in Australia, how music came out, and then it became very involved in how dancing came out to Australia, and then eventually how sport came out to Australia. So following one thread sort of unpulled the other. So you can imagine a tapestry, you pull out one thread and a whole of other threads are interconnected to it, and it's a view that you don't see. So you can be obviously given a cartoon view of a tapestry, but this is up looking at microscopic version of the tapestry, looking at a different distance. And again, this case is to try and develop a more strategic, nuanced view. So let's start it off. As I talked about, there's going to be a scaffold. So Australia is in the southern hemisphere, And there's going to be a series of voyages to Australia. There's the 1770 discovery, I suppose you can call it discovery, first knowledge of Australia. That is, for Europeans, it's the discovery. I suppose discovery is the word you use. In 1770, by Captain James Cook, in a ship called the Endeavour. So this is a... by the standards of the time, the Endeavour was similar to a cargo ship. It was a coal ship, but it was a specialist-designed ship, designed to hold a lot of stores and therefore go on a long sustained voyage. It's sort of like if I was launching out into the sea, and I didn't know if I could survive, I'd like to go in a cargo ship rather than a pleasure cruiser, because a pleasure cruiser, you'd run out of the caviar very quickly. In a cargo ship, you can have thousands of stores. So that's the Endeavour. That's one. Number two is 1788 is the first fleet, a group of 11 or 12 ships, again to military escorts, and 9 or 10 other ships, which are basically cargo ships with a human cargo, is the first fleet. The second fleet, a similar thing, but not run with the imprimatur of the Royal Navy, but more of a commercially oriented thing, sort of like the government's done it once, and now we're handing it over to private enterprise. And then the third fleet. And there is a story of the evolution of sport in these four journeys out to Australia. Now, amazingly, asking the questions to clarify it, to make sure everything's understood, I've had to develop that first. So let's go up to the first discovery of Australia in the Endeavour in 1770. Now, the idea of this was a mission, a scientific mission by the British to observe the transit of Venus. So the transit of Venus was set up by British leading British scientists, and sold as a equivalent to landing on the moon. The science of the seeing the transit of Venus. So this is where Venus actually travels in front of the sun, and you can imagine this as a little fly flying in front of a large globe, and seeing how long the fly takes to fly across the large globe. Now, a toddler who's low down will see the fly, depending on where the fly is, fly at a different altitude to the to an adult who's standing up. So an adult standing up will look down, and depending where it is, if it's in the bottom half, it will be close to the south pole of the sun, and if the toddler will see it closer to the equator, so someone at the of the sun, so someone who's down lower will actually see the sun take longer to go across. And if you're doing some clever maths, you can actually start to work out the distance to the Earth, to the sun, and then you, hey presto, the guesswork's gone out. You can actually get all the distances to everything in the at least in the solar system, in good old miles. So the distance from London to Kent, you can actually say that's a certain number of multitudes. So that was the aim of it. And going down to Tahiti in the southern hemisphere was getting down as low down as possible. And so the different times of transit actually gave it to you there. So Captain Cook, who is a damn fine astronomer, was able to identify, do the transit, build a transit camp. Now, when he went on the ship, the Royal Navy kicked off the scientists, because last time they let the scientists run a naval expedition, that they got the actual iron discipline wrong and nearly got a mutiny with it. That's why they put Cook in charge, kicked off the scientists, made the scientists subservient, and then someone who would see this is going to be fantastic. So it was well advertised that the British were going down to Tahiti. Now, the big story of the British going down to Tahiti is a story that they were going to get access to the Spanish world. So the Spain owned everything. And they were going to use the Jesuits to get down there, and they put all the diplomatic effort with the Jesuits, but just at the last moment the Jesuits lost favour with the Spanish Empire, and then the British were cut off. So the British had to find a way of going down there. They were well financed by now. I think it was getting well into the Seven Years' War, so that Britain was, you know, a damn fine shipbuilding, so they got everything down. So the major thing is that they were able to pay for paying customers, a bit like Elon Musk believes in space tourism. You know, there's going to be big paying customers for a person who wants to get out there and experience. And that paying customer was none other than Joseph Banks, who was a landed gent who loved shooting things and collecting flowers. And you understand that people are, none of the textbook secrets were open secrets, and he was used to check himself for scurvy every day by looking at his mouth, and drink various tonics which were advised to him, so that's the scurvy, the medical aspect of it. The other medical aspect was he was keenly aware of the need for physical activity to keep fit on ships. Now, the British were beginning to understand that this in terms of exercise of their sailors, but as a passenger he took on board a skipping rope. That's right. The first paying customer, the sort of the eyes of the Enlightenment. So, if you could say that Cook was a military professional, but Banks was a more enlightened gentleman. He was sitting on the deck with his gun, shooting birds of the Endeavour, which has made its way across from Tahiti. Doing a loop of New Zealand, and there is a story about how Cook got New Zealand so right, is because he was such a damn fine astronomer, and so Cook's been able to see the positions of the stars, we were able to work out the position of the boat, which led to such an excellent mapping. So he's a mapping a savant almost in terms of mapping and that type of stuff. But Banks was different, and made the people perfectly aware that if you want to survive a journey, you've got to eat, well, what they wound up eating is lots of sauerkraut. I'd hate to be actually under board the Endeavour. It would be a really farty sort of ship. Ultimately, you can imagine them farting away. And the other thing was exercise. So that's there. So Banks goes back as an enlightened person and says, you lost America, you need a place to put your convicts. I recommend the discovery of Australia. Now, Banks was also selling a popular book, so there's a sort of I suppose, cognitive bias, as we'd politely call it now. And so he managed to get the British to send a test fleet out to Australia. And of course, at this time, there's a tussle between the Russian Empire and the British Empire. The British were having their sources in Latvia, Estonia, to the large masks to mass produce their ships threatened, and you need masks and you need rope and you need rigging. So the idea was that the powers are going to cut off Britain's superpower status. So Britain really came of age in the Seven Years' War. Okay, so we've got the first fleet and the first view of sport. So there's someone practicing basically what we call Fitbit type of personal trainer sort of viewpoint there. And this personal trainer person, the sport SMAD person. There's a person who suggested Australia. Now, Australia was a solution to many, many problems. There was a solution to the convicts. It was also a solution to access to wood and flax, believe it or not. So I'll go into that story later. So as soon as the first fleet came ashore, the first thing they did was, before doing anything, they got in their axes and cut down a few trees. And you can see this in the picture there of doing it. So the first fleet arrived. It was run by the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy was rather obsessed with keeping people alive for simple practical purposes. That if you lost people, the way that they dealt with the loss of people is actually overstock their ships with people before they set off. And of course, overstocking with people, it was a whole heap of problems with doing that. So if your ship was going to lose a third of its people and you required so many people to be, 100 people to be effective, you'd put 133 people in the ship and just factor in the fact, the loss factor. So the Royal Navy was definitely aware of this. And so a large number of the convicts the first fleet got there alive. The second fleet was a bit different. It wasn't run by the... it was run by, if you imagine, a startup company's Convicts R Us. And the second fleet arrived. So the first fleet got there, and the plan was the second fleet would arrive replete with resources and fit people ready to go. And of course, this didn't happen. I do believe that the second fleet supply ship, which had all the food. The idea is you put all the food on one ship, and so no one can actually mutiny because they can't actually travel away from the food ship. So it's sort of like a magnet there, because that ship, I believe, struck an iceberg and had... Well, because getting down to the Southern Ocean, you've got to get the winds right. So the winds are best in the Southern Ocean. So you can imagine these huge waves and icebergs about the place. So, yeah, the first fleet and second fleet definitely did see icebergs. Absolutely confused the living daylights out of the various convicts trying to work out. We're going to a hot place and there's icebergs in place. You know, they obviously didn't have a full... say, and now here's for your geography lesson. So they all they arrived, no food, and most of the convicts were dead or very, very sick, because the contract said number of convicts delivered. It didn't actually say, and they must be alive and ready to work. And so the second fleet comes along, and the second fleet is the no sport, no fun for convicts thing. And just like the live sheep trade now, a lot of them don't make it. And so you've got a colony really trying to work itself, survive. Now, the thing is that the thing that sold the British coming on is they asked the banks about the Aboriginal occupants of the land, and these documents are killer documents to read through. And Max said, look, the Aboriginals don't pose a military threat. I think it was under 200 soldiers, even possibly 100 soldiers to start off with, the Marines to go out. And by the time you put the ranks people, there's actually I don't know, there's be you could fit them like there'd be a lot, but there's not a massive amount, so you could they'd fill up say a quarter of a soccer field as I'm watching here. Okay, so second fleet is a bit of a disaster. Letters are going back and forth to England all the time, so I don't quite understand this. There must be other ships without convicts and out supplies sort of passing by all the time, or a method of getting a letter up to the Dutch East Indies and getting things back. So they say, look, we've got to fix this. And so by the third fleet, there's a change, and the convicts are brought up for air dancing. And as it turns out, for dancing requires music. And there we see the origin of Australian music, or Irish music, which goes into the pubs and things like that. But it's an amazing thing that the actual convicts coming out, they learn about sport or physical fitness before they learn about the place they're coming to. And so this is a really important thing, an important observation to ponder. Now, I suppose this is interesting in terms of that I've often wanted to have a discussion with history teachers and talk about things, and there's very much an idea of what's in a syllabus and what's an official view and what's an interesting view, but don't tell anyone because it's not there. And I'm not telling anyone, but it's an interesting thing to know that sport and fitness was an essential ingredient to having people survive long enough to reach Australia. Now, we don't know how the sport continued. We do know that when there were sporting fixtures very early on, there was great interest and great attendance. It's not necessarily about the Convicts, but we can definitely follow that this use of music did actually travel across from Ireland. So the a lot of the hotels or drinking spots, what we'll call them, would be very lively, musical, social events, and this sort of social culture, which was brought across in the boats, a survival technique, actually transplanted across, and they're now uncovering a lot of the old ballads and music. You know, you can imagine the Irish violins at the start of the music at the start of Titanic, that wistful music, and of course river dance is the Irish dancing is sort of key to what's going on, and I suppose it is interesting that Australia had a craze that I think America missed, thank goodness, and it's called the stomp, and that's where people would actually just all stomp on the ground at the same time and actually test the foundations of their upstairs dance hall. This is a podcast about the sporting history of Australia. Again, it's not from a historical expert, it's from someone who has been studying up about Australian history, studying up in family history about the music, the credibility of some of the music stories, and to find out that the views of music are shifting, and this means that the views of sport can shift, and its role, or the way that it's handled in Australian culture, may actually solve some of the problems which are besetting Australian sport, where it seems to have lost its way. That is, the community goodwill gets paid to across to the club, but then there's these big structures which actually take the money and put it up to the central point, and then it filters it down, and then none of the money gets there. That's a fundamental problem. And then the view of the dissociation from Australian society as we produce these hard-to-understand megastars. And then we have the ball tampering viewpoint. And so there's a whole lot of things, and then you've got the stories of sport was always played in World War I trenches. There's a whole history of it. It seems to be an iconic a thing of cultural value, but we've got to really wrestle that cultural value and actually place it amongst the other things that we as a country are discussing, rather than just leaving it up to the commercial William Hill gambling venture. It's not necessarily just the thing where it's not sports, just not a basically a sophisticated roulette wheel where you don't know what's going on. There's something a little bit more to it, which I'm seeing here. It's the ability to think. So there's a whole lot of psychology, the ability to think as a team and to actually understand tactics and thinking and be able to empathise with people. So this is why people watch sport, because they see something and they can experience emotions by seeing people doing it. Also, there's the physiology of, you know, oxygenated and the mood associated with that. I hope I've covered all of that. This is another Peter Hill Explains. And in the meantime, keep on thinking philosophically, strategically, and scientifically. Thanks for listening.